Welcome to Local Matters Health Matters. Each week, we bring you conversations that help you and your family make informed health decisions based on evidence and expert advice. Today, we're talking about something especially important for those of us living in Tennessee, and it's tick-borne illnesses. Whether you're hiking, gardening, hunting, fishing, or simply spending time in your own backyard, ticks can pose serious health risk. We'll also spend some time discussing alpha-gal syndrome, a condition many people have heard about but may not fully understand. Joining us today is Michelle Lee Coombe, family nurse practitioner. Michelle, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Michelle, this is Jennifer.
Hello.
I want to, we'll start out by just talking in general, maybe about tick-borne illnesses, because they've been getting a whole lot of attention in the news.
Yes.
People wanting to get blood tests done. You know, are they actually becoming more common, or is it just that the media is kind of hyping it?
They definitely are becoming more common as we see ticks, you know, spreading and becoming more active out in our woods and trees and all those things. So as that happens, as there's more tick population, then we're seeing more tick-borne illnesses for sure.
So then why are these tick-borne diseases such an important issue then for families, especially here in the Upper Cumberland? Is this a special region, or, you know, kind of explain?
So in Tennessee, we are known to be one of the hot spots for tick-borne illnesses.
And not in a good way.
Okay. Exactly. Because one reason is we have, you know, we have long seasons, kind of. It's always kind of warm here. Ticks like to be warm, and I always joke that one of the things that they've noticed alpha-gal in every continent except Antarctica. So, you know, obviously it doesn't like Antarctica. It wants to stay away from the cold. But they like the sunshine, and so Tennessee particularly has a very long season where we're able to be outdoors. You know, we may be able to be outdoors in November, so in December. So in Tennessee, we have a very active tick population, and you probably see people here, man, I've really seen lots of ticks this year in my backyard, and I feel like that's becoming more common. And again, it just goes back to how much time that we are able to spend outdoors here in Upper Cumberland. You know, you have all the state parks, and people love to hike and just be outdoors, and the ticks love that as well.
Mm-hmm. So are tick bites something everyone should take seriously, or are most bites harmless, would you say?
So most bites are harmless, but I would take every tick bite seriously. The biggest thing you want to do is prevention, you know, where you're your insect repellent for tick repellent, particularly ones with DEET and permethrin, things that are going to keep those off of you. Everyone is something that could be serious. We don't know. You know, with every tick bite, you want to remove it as early as possible, and, you know, do first aid, you know, simple wound care, that kind of thing. But you want to be sure to, if you're having any types of symptoms such as fever, rash, body aches, flu-like symptoms, anything like that, you want to take it very seriously and follow up with a physician or provider.
Okay. So back to the seasons, is there a certain time of the year you see more cases? I know you said, you know, in Tennessee we have this really long season because we're so warm, and then we get cold, and then we're warm, and it never stays cold for a long period of time.
Right.
So is there a certain time of the year people should be more cautious?
So spring to early fall are going to be your
so pretty much the
time.
Whole year. No, I'm
kidding. So, so like we said, in Tennessee you're going to have
three seasons.
It could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be,
okay.
You know, December or you find a tick. But yeah. Particularly spring to early fall is your hottest time.
Okay. Are there certain outdoor activities that you think put people at greater risk?
Absolutely. So we want to be particularly diligent in tick prevention when you are hiking, camping, working out in the yard, boating, you know, being along the shoreline, any of those things. But even being out in the soccer field or the football field, you know, there may be ticks in that area too. Backyards are a wonderful place for ticks to hang out, especially in the South where lots of us have farm animals, or we may have, or we all have dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm. And I think of dogs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and the dogs mm-hmm. can always bring in ticks as well. So you got to be really diligent in those areas.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I have two long-haired German Shepherds, and so this year especially, we have seen a lot of live ticks coming yes. in on them into the home because they, you know, sleep in the house. And, you know, I think it is a misnomer that people think, oh, I'm outside. You know, well, I don't go outside, so I'm not going to get a tick. But right. you're right. The pets and the farm animals can bring mm-hmm. that indoors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Great point. Let's go ahead and start talking about illnesses then that most people are likely to hear about. Probably the oldest one that I can remember, you know, Rocky Mountain spotted fever. That's what most people equate with a tick-borne disease. So Absolutely. What is, you know, and it is considered one of the more serious tick-borne diseases, which yes. all of them can be. But what is that? What is Rocky Mountain spotted fever?
So I'm like you, Rocky Mountain spotted fever is kind of the first one I ever heard about, the one we are most commonly see, the one that I most commonly see in clinic, in a rural mm-hmm. Walk-in clinic mm-hmm. is Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So it is from a tick, of course, and it is a bacteria that you can get from the tick. And the biggest thing, it kind of tells you in the title what to look for. So Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So the spotted part is you typically have a rash mm-hmm. And then you're going to typically have a fever. And that's going to kind of vary in your symptomology. You know, you may have some, you may feel really bad. You may feel okay and just have a rash and just spike a fever. But it does need to be treated pretty quickly. And from the healthcare guidelines that we follow is that if we suspect Rocky Mountain spotted fever, we go ahead and start treating that with an antibiotic mm-hmm. because you do the blood test and then you go ahead and start treatment. And then if the blood test is negative, then you can and stop the treatment. But if not, you want to go ahead and finish out the course of the antibiotic.
So especially a fever and a rash.
Fever and a rash.
Is it a rash all over the body, or is it just a rash that's located in one area?
So it's really going to depend on the person. Mm-hmm. But what I have seen in clinic is typically if you've had a bite on your leg, you're going to have a rash on your leg. So. Okay. It's not necessarily that way. You right, know, I always right. say nobody follows the textbook like they're supposed
true.
To.
True.
But yeah, it's kind of not always a localized area, but often it is.
Okay. All right.
So is it the rash or the fever? What's the earliest symptom, I guess? What would they experience first?
From what I've seen in clinic, I would say they typically come pretty close together.
Okay.
You may notice the rash probably first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, wait.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
like,
I don't feel
this?
Good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
So then what's the importance of not delaying treatment with
so
that?
Rocky Mountain spotted fever is one that can absolutely be fatal. Every tick-borne illness is a little different, but Rocky Mountain spotted fever, I always say, is one that is real serious as far as fatality. So you want to definitely – it will continue to progress if you're not treated and can be fatal.
Okay.
Okay, so another tick illness that we hear about a lot is ehrlichiosis.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about what it is and how common it is in Tennessee?
So I personally haven't seen this as much or maybe ever, to be honest. I have, of course, heard about it. It is one that also is from a tick bite, and it is going to cause more of your flu-like symptoms like headache, muscle aches, fatigue. Any of the tick-borne illnesses we talk about today can cause nausea, vomiting. Mm-hmm. So there is that. It can cause a rash. Again, every one of the tick-borne illnesses can cause a rash, but some of them are more susceptible to having a rash. This isn't one that's more susceptible. This one is more, you're going to worry more about your older adults, your small children. Children may develop a rash, and a lot of these are questions as to is it just an immune response or mm-hmm. is it truly a tick-borne rash? Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say, especially with ehrlichiosis, which that plays into. But that's another one that you're going to, you know, kind of want to watch for those symptoms and go see a provider as soon as you can.
That is one that I don't think I heard about as much until I got into practicing in rural Tennessee. But, you know, like Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, Lyme disease, yes. You'd heard about those for years. Yes. But I'm like you, I haven't seen as many people actually have that one. Have you, Jennifer? Yeah.
Have you?
I have. Typically, they have swelling in their lower legs for some reason with the ehrlichiosis, mm-hmm. with the fever. It's kind of a weird combo. That's not all the time, like you said, Michelle. But so with ehrlichiosis, what symptoms are specific? So I'm thinking you said headache.
Mm-hmm. More like the flu-like symptoms.
Okay, all mm-hmm. over, body hurt.
Yeah.
Okay.
Muscle right. legs, yeah.
And that also can become serious if not treated
yes.
early enough. And absolutely. Then in order for people to know for sure if they have Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever or ehrlichiosis, are there options out there as a provider?
Yes. So one thing that I've always done as a provider, and we've kind of been trained to do, is if, and especially as these tick-borne illnesses are becoming more common, is to kind of do the whole tick panel. Mm-hmm. So you're going to add, and that's where most of my knowledge from ehrlichiosis is from doing the whole tick-borne panel. Mm-hmm. So blood test is going to be the way to test for that. And in that panel, you'll have the Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, the ehrlichiosis, the Babesia, say that one right. But all those different blood tests are going to be mm-hmm. in that panel.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about Lyme disease then.
Welcome back to Local Matters, Health Matters. And today we're joined by Michelle Coombe. She's a family nurse practitioner. And we're talking about tick-borne illnesses. The last segment, we talked mostly about Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, ehrlichiosis. So many people automatically think of Lyme disease when they hear tick bite, because that was a very common one. We talked about how common Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever was. So how common is Lyme disease in Tennessee compared to other parts of the country?
So Lyme disease is the one, like you said, that you always hear about. And we typically think of that as being kind of a northeastern illness because it started in Lyme, Connecticut. That's where it gets its name. So we typically see more cases up there. It's not as prevalent down here in Tennessee as it is in the Northeast, but is becoming more prevalent as ticks kind of migrate down from up north as it gets warmer down here and, you know, those kind of things. But different ticks typically transmit or are vectors for different illnesses. And the black leg tick is the one that is associated more with Lyme. So we don't have as many of those as we do like the Lone Star tick, which is the Lone Star tick is the one that we attribute to Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever and is the primary vector for alpha-gal syndrome, which we'll talk about in a minute, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, we will. Yeah. So what are the symptoms of Lyme disease?
So with Lyme, you're going to have a lot of joint pain. Lyme is one that I always say it's probably not going to be fatal, but you might feel like you just want to die. You know, you're just going to feel really, really bad.
Yeah.
Achy, mm-hmm. can turn chronic, can have a lot of different just nagging, kind of almost autoimmune type reactions. And that's another one we can test for. It is more difficult to get a true diagnosis of Lyme because there's not a perfect test, and the tests are a little confusing, and there's like a whole little flow chart you got to follow. But Lyme is definitely one that's getting more attention in the media, so I feel like we'll have more questions about Lyme and more folks asking to be tested for Lyme.
And I think that joint pain and the aches, the body aches, I feel like that's what seems to linger on for mm-hmm. people. Joint pain, myalgias, fatigue.
Yep.
Don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like
that's the problem, though, yeah. I think, is people wait.
Because they don't realize what it is.
They don't realize what it is, yeah.
Yeah. I think so too.
Especially in the spring time.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that we didn't mention was the bullseye rash.
Oh, yes.
Does everyone develop the famous bullseye rash with Lyme disease?
No. So probably 30-ish percent do not develop the bullseye rash. And that is something that we're, you know, again, textbook. We're like, it's got to be. It's
the easier,
not,
wasn't it?
Yeah. It's not Lyme. You didn't have the bullseye rash. But I have also seen a similar type rash in other tick-borne illnesses that did not end up being Lyme. So the bullseye rash is not completely predictive of whether you're going to have Lyme or not, or any tick-borne illness, really.
Yeah.
So let's move on to alpha-gal. And I know, Michelle, that is something that you've really been passionate about. For the listeners, she has written a book called Ticked Off, From Bite to Diagnosis, and it's about understanding alpha-gal syndrome. That is one of the main topics we wanted to have you on for today. So, and it's getting a lot of attention. I know, back 2014, 2015, when it kind of first emerged, listeners back then weren't really familiar with it. It seems more in the mainstream now because there are tests for it. And so what exactly is alpha-gal syndrome?
So alpha-gal syndrome is, like she said, becoming more prevalent. Mm-hmm. We're having more and more diagnosis with it. So it is a allergy that you develop from a tick bite, and you develop an allergy to a sugar molecule called galactose alpha 1,3 galactose. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to say that every time.
It's big words right there.
So we're going to say alpha-gal syndrome. Or AGS is even better. But so this comes primarily, the primary vector is the Lone Star tick. And it is an allergy that happens not every time, but sometimes it can be severe. So you develop this antibody to the alpha-gal, which is the sugar molecule. And alpha-gal is in all mammals. But you don't, you can develop an antibody to it, so then your body's kind of fighting against it. So what ends up happening is you can have a reaction to mammal as you eat them. So it's, so as you ingest any type of mammalian products, beef, pork, venison, lamb, you know, any of those mammal meats, you can have a reaction which can vary from just a simple hive-like reaction all the way to anaphylaxis. There is also a subset of these folks that only have GI distress. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it very difficult to diagnose. The hallmark point that kind of alerts a provider to know that this may be a alpha-gal reaction is because it happens delayed. Mm-hmm. So with your peanut allergy, for example, you are reacting to the protein in the peanut, and so it's an immediate reaction. With alpha-gal, it is an IgE-mediated reaction, but it's to the sugar molecule, so therefore it takes your body a little longer to break it down. Mm-hmm. So then it can be 2, 6, 8 hours a delay. So one of the hallmark things that points us to maybe this is alpha-gal is if you're waking up in the middle of the night having GI distress or having an anaphylactic reaction, which can happen. So that's one of the things that kind of points us to alpha-gal. So you could go many, many years suffering with alpha-gal syndrome and not knowing that you have alpha-gal.
So you talk about it's an allergic reaction versus the other ones we talked about. You said those were bacterias.
Yes.
So the tick gives you a bacteria. You have a localized reaction, and you can get an antibiotic for it to get over it. So alpha-gal is different from what you're telling the listeners, that it's an allergic reaction.
Yes.
And so it can be all over the body. Am I understanding that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. You can have all the symptoms of any other allergic reaction.
Okay.
Because your body has built up those antibodies to try to fight off that alpha gal.
Well, then how is it diagnosed? If it takes years and years, mm-hmm. you know, or and it's a delayed reaction, how does the provider diagnose that?
So it's a very simple test, actually.
Okay.
So you just do an IgE allergy to, you do the IgE alpha gal.
Mm-hmm.
Typically what I recommend is go ahead and do all the IgE to the proteins too, the beef, pork, lamb.
Right.
Just
yeah.
to
right.
also see, do you have a protein allergy to that, or is the alpha gal the true allergy? So just a simple blood test that your doctor can, or provider can do.
How long does this last? Is this a lifetime diagnosis?
So with alpha-gal syndrome, we don't know a whole lot about it. As Jennifer stated, it hasn't been very known. We're learning new information every day. There's not a ton of research on it at all. And so it takes some time to get the diagnosis because it's very vague also. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of people that can just go, you know, and just have these little things that they're not putting together is actually a reaction to the alpha gal. So at one point, the CDC put out a study that said it was up to 7 years that people were suffering with alpha gal before they got a true diagnosis.
Mm.
So as providers, that's where we really need to be proactive in that if we start noticing certain things like GI distress, any
dietary
unusual,
intolerances,
yes,
yeah.
mm-hmm. and any unusual reactions to things that you can't explain is, you know, go ahead and test for alpha gal, even if they don't know that they've had a tick bite.
Okay, so more when we come back on tick-borne illnesses. Welcome back to Local Matters Health Matters. Today we're here with Michelle Coombe, and she's a family nurse practitioner who specializes in tick-borne illnesses. And so, Michelle, in the last segment, we were talking about alpha gal. And you talked about, you know, how important it was to get an accurate diagnosis, and it can take a long time. And we didn't get to answer the part about, you know, can alpha gal improve over time, or is this a lifetime diagnosis?
So there's no evidence to prove that it is something that you grow out of or you can get rid of with different types of therapies. So that is something I want to stress with folks is right now we don't know. You can, as you track the IgE levels as they go down, some people are able to add back in some mm-hmm. foods.
Yeah,
I will say anecdotally, I've seen a lot of people who could add back in the mammal products and then they would have a severe reaction. So I don't recommend testing it on your own. And even the IgE antibody level does not correspond with the reaction that you can have.
Right.
So you could have just a small increase in that IgE level, and you could have an anaphylactic reaction. So there's no real correlation with how severe your reaction is going to be. And again, the thing that is the most difficult for providers to diagnose and for patients to deal with is it is not an every time allergy. It is just whenever your body just decides that it doesn't mm-hmm. want to do that. So you may be able to eat hamburger tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
but then you may have an anaphylactic reaction to a glass of milk the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about anaphylaxis? We've said that a lot, but I don't think we actually explained what that is. A lot of people know, but some may not.
Gotcha. So when you typically think about anaphylaxis, you're going to think about when you have your throat closing, you can't breathe, shortness of breath. But you can also have different, as if you have multiple body systems that are having reactions. So if you have a rash and you're vomiting, or, you know, you've got a little shortness of breath and a rash, you know, there's things that you can kind of look at and see if you have multiple body systems that are reacting to something, then that can be considered anaphylaxis.
Okay.
So you'll want to treat with, hopefully, if you have a diagnosis that would cause you to need an EpiPen, you would use an EpiPen. And they always say, when in doubt, use the EpiPen. You know, if you yeah. think this is a reaction than do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But getting to that first diagnosis to get that EpiPen,
yes,
I think patients and providers also need to be very diligent, it sounds like.
Yes.
And just, or being open to this could be the problem that these people are having.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that sound? You know, it comes from a tick. We talked about a Lone Star tick. We've talked about brown ticks. We've talked about black-legged ticks. Mm-hmm. What ticks are most common here in Tennessee?
So Lone Star tick is one of the most common. The dog tick is one that's common. The black-legged tick, which is also, in the South, we're probably going to call that the deer tick.
Yeah.
So those are our primary ones that we see. And, you know, like you asked in the beginning, any tick can transmit a bacteria,
mm-hmm.
but not every tick does. So we have to look at each one. And they do recommend keeping the tick, not just for the excitement of it, but to actually show your provider, because we could kind of guide what testing to do based on what the tick was, you know, which one it was. It's identified.
Mm-hmm. Are there any methods people should avoid, such as using petroleum jelly, nail polish, alcohol, or anything like that, trying to remove ticks?
So our best bet is going to be to take fine tip tweezers and remove the tick, mm-hmm. and make sure you get the head of the tick.
Okay.
There are things online that you can buy that kind of slip up under the tick and can kind of help twist it out. I do have those, and I recommend them because I have a child with alpha-gal syndrome, and he is a tick magnet. So we do have the little tick remover, but just make sure fine tip tweezers and remove the head. And don't burn the tick. We don't want anybody catching anybody on fire. We don't want, you know, petroleum jelly smothering it. All those things are not as effective.
Okay, so getting the tick off with the head. Yes. And the mouth parts is what I'm hearing. And then that way, yeah. And if you can, bringing it dead,
yes,
to to your provider.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No,
yes. Or take a picture of it. You,
yes,
know,
that's
a lot of people have cell
too.
Phones. So I think, yeah, just take a picture of it if you can't.
Great idea.
Bring it in.
Yeah, true.
Great idea.
So the good news is that tick bites are preventable, absolutely. It sounds like. And what are your top recommendations then for preventing tick bites?
So the biggest thing is to use those insect repellents. If you are going camping, hiking, they do actually have pants that have, mm-hmm. built-in.
Permethrin.
Yes.
I have seen those.
Yes. Yeah. My son is an avid camper, and he wears those, thankfully. But even if you're going to go camp and spray your tent, spray your equipment, anything that's going to have access to the outdoors that could possibly have a tick. If you're in just your backyard, make sure that even if you don't have time to put on the insect repellent or whatever, make sure when you get inside, do a tick check and just jump in the shower, wash everything off. So hopefully if there is any of them crawling around you, they're going to go off with the water.
Mm-hmm.
If you notice a tick, definitely get it off as soon as possible with the head and mouth. And then just watch over the next few days to weeks to make sure you don't develop any types of post-tick exposure reaction.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions was, you know, what should families do after they've done these activities we talked about that, you know, put some more at risk, like hiking, camping, you know, gardening, being out in the yard, whatever it may be. So jumping in the shower, and something I've always told my children, you know, look, you know, try to give yourself a good look over.
Absolutely.
You know, and look at the places that they like to navigate towards.
Yes.
To, you know, to make sure you don't have any in that area. So taking a shower, you said, mm-hmm. searching the body. Anything else that people need to do after they've came in from activities? I can't think of anything.
I can't think of anything. Anything major, but we do definitely do a tick check every day, especially for my little boy who's outside all the time mowing the yard, and he's a tick magnet, so we're always checking.
Mm-hmm.
Is there things that homeowners can do around their home? I mean, you've talked about clothing and prevention. Is there anything they can do to reduce tick populations?
There is, especially if you have like an exterminator, one of those outdoor ones, you know, you can spray around. There are some things, and I wouldn't even begin to tell you exactly what they are, but there are some natural things that you can put around your house to avoid, you know, if you don't want to use chemicals. But,
yeah,
I don't know those off the top of my head. But
no, that's all right. That's all right. I mean, I'd heard things like spearmint and peppermint, you know, putting those around your home. I think it's almost like anything with a loud scent. You know, probably. My husband does mothballs everywhere, which it does not smell great sometimes.
It does not.
But you know what? It keeps away the critters, and maybe that's what keeps away the ticks, you know, and that may be what the correlation is, and it's not an actual
prevention. They're like, it stinks here. Yeah. We'll go somewhere else. And we already mentioned that pets can bring ticks into the home. Mm-hmm. Yes. So making sure that either you're treating your pets or checking your pets, whatever it is that you like to do with your pets.
Yeah.
I think that's important, too.
Yep. Yes. Especially when they're crawling on them alive and then they come into the home.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's happened.
Get rid of those.
Yes, exactly.
And we've talked about removing them, you know, and saving them, how to remove them safely. You did mention that every tick bite does not require antibiotics.
Correct.
So when would you tell the listeners that they should tell, you know, they should contact their healthcare provider after they find a tick?
So typically what I've noticed in clinic and just in research and case reports is oftentimes there will be some type of rash with most of these tick-borne illnesses, even with alpha-gal. And so if you're having a rash, if you have a fever at all within the first week to even a month out, sometimes you have your body has to build those antibodies before you start having the actual symptoms. So if you have a fever, rash, body aches, even if you don't, an important point that I do like to make is even if you don't know that you've had a tick bite, because one thing that they're really finding in alpha-gal research is that it could be what most of us in Tennessee consider chiggers are actually seed ticks that are transmitting the alpha-gal. So even if you don't know you've had a tick, if you present with rash, fever, any types of aches, any type of GI distress, as providers, we should look at that as should we test them for tick-borne illnesses. And patients should be, you know, thinking that in their head too, that maybe I live on a farm. You know, no, I haven't pulled a tick off of me, but I do have around ticks a lot. So,
very good. Well, Michelle, where can people get more information about this? And maybe I know you have your book out. I'd like for you to kind of mention that briefly, just for the listeners if they have questions or want to learn more about this.
So, I do have a nonprofit. It's called Living. The website is called LivingWithAlphaGalEducationAlliance.org. And that is, you'll find a lot of information there about alpha-gal.
Okay.
My book is also linked there. The book, I will say, is for when you are kind of first diagnosed and you're like, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. You know, because my son was like, can I eat dairy? What can I do? You know, he was six when he was diagnosed. So you just have a lot of questions. And these are some basic questions and answers that you can have. Also, if you're interested in getting tested for alpha-gal syndrome, my personal telehealth website is renewedexpressionswellness.com. And on there, you can actually just order an alpha-gal test and we can talk about
that. Okay, say that one more time. Renewed.
Renewedexpressionswellness.com.
Okay, all one word.
Yep.
All right. So if you can leave our listeners with three simple things everybody should do to reduce their risk of tick-borne disease this year, what would they be?
I would say definitely do a good tick check when you come inside.
Yes.
Prevention is the key to it all. One thing I want to throw in about alpha-gal is please use sources that are evidence-based and are not just things you hear on TikTok and the internet. There are a lot of misinformation about tick illnesses on the internet, so I want to make sure you use a well-respected, evidence-based source.
Perfect. I agree with that. And thank you, Michelle. And thank you to our listeners for joining in today for another episode of Local Matters, Health Matters. Until next time, stay healthy and take care.